A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been hauling boxes in the Israeli summer sun. A self move. Middle of July. Midday heat. And the only thing that got him through it was ducking inside periodically to sit in front of an air conditioner on full blast. He says that experience crystallized something for him. We talk constantly about the environmental cost of AC, and we should. But he thinks there's a danger in pursuing restrictions blindly, and he's got a policy idea that sounds radical until you sit with it for a minute. His proposal: build what he calls a cold sanctuary in every neighborhood, a public space where the AC runs at full, open to anyone who needs to cool off, read a book, browse the internet, just don't disrupt others. A code of conduct that isn't quite library strict but close. And he's asking two things. First, has any city actually built something like this already, and maybe found a better name for it? Second, he points to what he calls a quiet asymmetry in the AC policy debate. It's easy to crack down on air conditioning from a country that doesn't need it. He's looking at the Nordics. Live somewhere like Israel, and those policies start to look less like sustainability and more like inflicting misery. So today we're asking, what happens when the policy to save the planet forgets the people already living on it? And has any city already built the thing Daniel is imagining?
Let's start with the tension that Daniel's story surfaces. The AC unit as both villain and savior. Air conditioning accounts for roughly 10% of global electricity consumption. The IEA projects that triples by 2050. The emissions feedback loop is real. You burn fossil fuels to run AC, which warms the planet, which makes you run more AC. It's a difficult problem. And yet. Heat stress is the leading cause of weather-related death globally. The WHO has been saying this for years, and the numbers keep getting worse. The summer of 2023 was the hottest on record at the time. 2024 broke that. 2025 broke that again. We're now in 2026, and the idea of survival mode heat has become normal. That's a word that should terrify people.
Normalized misery. That's the phrase.
Right. And Daniel's story, hauling boxes, taking AC breaks to keep going, that's not unusual. That's a Tuesday in August for millions of people, construction workers, agricultural laborers, delivery drivers. People who don't have the option of working from an air-conditioned office. For them, AC isn't about comfort. It's about not ending up in an emergency room.
So the hidden danger in blindly restricting AC, and this is what I think Daniel's really poking at, is that a well-intentioned emissions policy becomes a de facto harm policy for the people least able to absorb it.
And to understand why, you have to look at what heat actually does to the human body. There's a specific physiological threshold that matters here. Wet bulb temperature of 35 degrees Celsius, that's 95 Fahrenheit, at 100% humidity. Beyond that point, sweating stops working. The air is too saturated for evaporation to cool your skin, and your core temperature rises uncontrollably. There's no acclimatization that gets you past this. It's a hard biological limit. AC is the only reliable intervention when you're approaching that threshold. Fans don't cut it, they just blow hot air around. Hydration helps, but it doesn't stop the core temperature rise. You need to actually reduce the ambient temperature and humidity around your body.
And who hits that wall first?
Outdoor laborers are at the top of the list. Construction, agriculture, roadwork. These are people who can't just stay inside during a heat advisory. Elderly people are next. Reduce sweat response as you age, and a lot of common medications interfere with thermoregulation. Beta blockers, diuretics, some antidepressants. Then there's the economic layer, low-income households who can't afford AC units or the electricity to run them. And people with cardiovascular or respiratory conditions, heat puts enormous strain on the heart.
So, the people who'd be hit hardest by AC restrictions are the same people who are already most vulnerable to heat. That's not a side effect. That's the main effect.
It is. And here's where the asymmetry Daniel mentioned gets really sharp. Nordic countries have AC adoption rates under 10% of households. European Environment Agency building stock data bears this out. Their summer peaks are mild, their heat waves are short, and their building stock is designed to retain heat, not shed it. When policymakers in those countries look at AC, they see a wasteful indulgence, something that Americans and Middle Easterners and South Asians run because they're soft. But try opening a window in Delhi in May. The India Meteorological Department recorded 52.3 degrees Celsius in Delhi in May of 2024. That's not a bit warm. That's approaching the wet bulb threshold in a city of over 30 million people. AC isn't optional there. And when policy discourse from temperate countries gets exported without adaptation, aggressive AC reduction targets, bans on new installations, punitive electricity pricing during summer peaks, you're essentially asking people in hot climates to absorb physiological risk so that policymakers in cold climates can hit their emissions targets.
Climate colonialism is a strong phrase, but I'm not sure it's wrong here.
It's uncomfortable, but the dynamic is real. The people making the most aggressive anti-AC arguments are often the ones who've never experienced the kind of heat where your body stops working. And they're making policy that affects people who experience it every summer.
Let me push on one thing, though. The emissions problem doesn't go away just because the need is genuine. If AC is tripling by 2050, that's a climate disaster regardless of whether it's saving lives in the short term.
No, that's right. And the BBC Future piece on the hidden health costs of AC makes this point well. AC saves lives during heat waves, but the emissions it produces create a feedback loop that makes heat waves worse over time. It's a genuine trap. But the solution can't be poor people in hot countries should just suffer more. That's not a climate policy. That's just cruelty with a carbon budget attached.
So what's the actual on-the-ground response been? Before we get to Daniel's proposal, what are cities doing right now when heat gets dangerous?
The main tool has been cooling centers. These are public buildings, community centers, libraries, schools, that get activated as temporary cooling spaces during heat emergencies. Phoenix opened a bunch of them during the 2023 heat wave. NPR covered this in July of that year. The city declared a heat emergency, set up these spaces with AC and water, and a lot of residents didn't know they existed. Or they knew, but couldn't get to them. Or the hours didn't work for people who needed them in the evening. The utilization numbers were low. And Phoenix is a city that knows heat. They've been dealing with this for decades. If they're struggling to make cooling centers work, imagine how it's going in cities that are experiencing extreme heat for the first time.
So the infrastructure exists on paper, but the awareness and access barriers make it less useful than it sounds.
Right, and most cooling centers are emergency activated, not permanent. They open when the temperature hits some threshold and close when it drops. There's no consistency. You can't plan your day around. Maybe the library will be open as a cooling center if the mayor declares an emergency.
Which brings us to Daniel's cold sanctuary idea. A permanent neighborhood space, AC running at full, open to anyone who needs it. No purchase required, no emergency declaration needed. Just go cool off.
And the interesting thing is, some cities are already doing versions of this. The closest match to what Daniel's describing is probably Barcelona's Refugees Climatics, climate shelters. The Barcelona City Council Climate Adaptation Plan has designated over 170 public spaces as permanent cooling points during summer months. Libraries, museums, civic centers. They're not purpose-built from scratch. They're existing buildings that get designated and equipped to handle the cooling function. The model is interesting. Extended hours during summer, no purchase required. You can sit, read, use the Wi-Fi, charge your phone. The code of conduct is basically respect the space. No sleeping overnight, no consuming food. It's not library strict, but it's not a free-for-all either.
So Daniel's cold sanctuary exists. They just called it something that sounds better in Catalan.
Pretty much. Miami-Dade County has something similar. They call them cool spots. It's a mapped network of public air-conditioned spaces. But again, mostly libraries and malls. Existing infrastructure, not purpose, built sanctuaries. Tokyo has experimented with chill zones and subway stations during extreme heat days. Pop-up cooling areas using mist and AC. But those are temporary installations, not permanent fixtures.
The Barcelona model seems like the strongest parallel. What's the catch?
The catch is that even 170 spaces in a city the size of Barcelona doesn't give you one in every neighborhood. And the respect the space model works until it doesn't. Some U.S. cooling centers have struggled with rules around loitering, sleeping, and substance use. The tension between open to all and safe for all is real, and it gets sharper the more vulnerable the population you're serving. There's also a knock-on effect worth thinking about. The BBC Future piece warns that AC creates what they call a thermal bubble. It disconnects people from their environment and reduces heat tolerance over time. If we build permanent cold sanctuaries everywhere, do we reduce the urgency to address the root causes? Urban heat island effect, building design, green infrastructure? Those are the things that actually make cities cooler without emissions.
I don't think those are intention, though. The sanctuary is a safety net. You still fix the roof even though you've got a bucket under the leak.
Agreed. They're complementary. The sanctuary catches the people who'd otherwise fall through. The outdoor worker who needs 30 minutes of cold air to reset, the elderly person whose apartment building doesn't have central AC, the parent with a kid who's overheating. While you're working on the systemic stuff, reflective roofing, tree canopy, phase change materials, and building envelopes, the sanctuary keeps people alive.
The systemic stuff takes decades. The sanctuary takes a community center and a decent HVAC unit.
And that's the part I think gets missed in a lot of climate adaptation discourse. The timeline mismatch. Retrofitting an entire city's building stock is a 30-year project. Planting trees that'll actually provide meaningful canopy coverage takes 15 to 20 years. People are experiencing dangerous heat right now, this summer. The sanctuary is an acknowledgement that adaptation has to work on multiple timescales simultaneously.
So, the proposal has legs. But before we get too idealistic about how these spaces would actually function, I want to hear from someone who's been on the inside of this.
Goodman 3-ton split system, model GSXI-teen. 16 SEER, ran it at 64 degrees all day, every day, for 3 summers. This was Phoenix. City-funded cooling center program. I was 22, 23. My job title was cooling center attendant, which meant I sat in a repurposed community center with the AC cranked to 18 Celsius, checked people in, and enforced the rules. No sleeping, no alcohol, no pets except service animals. Maximum stay of 2 hours. The 2-hour rule was the one that got me. We had people who'd come in, sit for 2 hours, leave, walk around the block, and come right back in, all day, effectively using this place as a daytime shelter. And I couldn't blame them. It was 115 outside, and they had nowhere else to go. But the rules said I had to track their time and turn them away if they'd hit the limit. We had a guy, I still think about this guy, he'd come in every day around 11, didn't talk to anyone, just sat in the corner and stared at the wall for 2 hours, never caused a problem, never made a sound. My supervisor pulled me aside one day and said he was making other visitors uncomfortable. Asked me to talk to him about, I don't know, looking less unsettling. I didn't do it. I just pretended I hadn't heard her. The code of conduct sounds reasonable on paper. Daniel's version? Quiet, no disruption, not library strict. That's about as good as it gets. But in practice, the people who need a cold space the most are often the ones who don't fit neatly into any code of conduct. They're homeless and just want to sleep somewhere cool. They're dealing with mental health issues and their behavior doesn't look normal to other visitors. They're kids with no supervision because their parents are working. The rules are there for a reason, but enforcing them means telling the most vulnerable person in the room that they have to go back outside.
The 2-hour limit, was that about turnover, or was it about preventing the space from becoming a de facto shelter?
Both. Official answer was turnover, give more people a chance to cool off. Unofficial answer was, we didn't want to become a homeless shelter. The city was very clear about that.
So the operational reality is that you spend half your time being a bouncer for a space that's supposed to be a refuge, and the people you're bouncing are the ones who need it most.
That's the job. I hated that part. We had a week in July where the overnight low never dropped below 95. The center was supposed to close at 8 p.m. People would be standing outside at 7:55 begging us to stay open. I'd call my supervisor and she'd say, follow the schedule. So I'd lock the doors and watch people walk back out into air that felt like an oven. Daniel's idea of a permanent space with no time pressure, that's better than what we had. But if you're going to do it, you have to decide up front whether it's a cooling space or a daytime shelter. Because if you don't decide, the people who show up will decide for you.
That's the tension, isn't it? Daniel's proposal inadvertently describes something closer to a 24-hour public space with very few restrictions. And the moment you build that, you're not building a cooling sanctuary anymore. You're building a different kind of institution entirely.
Which might be exactly what's needed. I mean, the distinction between a place to cool off and a place to exist. That distinction collapses when the temperature is 110 degrees. You can't cool off without existing somewhere. And if you don't have somewhere to exist, the cooling center becomes that place whether it was designed for it or not.
The guy who stared at the wall. He wasn't cooling off. He was waiting out the day. The AC was secondary. He needed somewhere to be. I don't know what the right answer is. I just know the 2-hour rule felt wrong then, and it feels wrong now.
So, the operational reality is messier than the concept. But I don't think that means the concept is wrong. It means we need to think harder about design and funding and rules. And who writes the rules?
The funding question is where this gets real. Barcelona's refugees' climatics are funded through the city's climate adaptation budget. Miami-Dade's cool spots are mostly just a map. The spaces already exist. The county just labels them. Phoenix's cooling centers are emergency funded, which means the money appears when there's a crisis and disappears when there isn't. If you want permanent cold sanctuaries in every neighborhood, purpose-built or retrofitted, properly staffed, open consistent hours, someone has to pay for the build-out and the ongoing operations. Cities are already cash-strapped. Is this a national climate adaptation fund item? Is it folded into public health budgets? Do we treat it like a library system, a public good that we fund because it benefits everyone, even the people who never walk through the door?
The library analogy is actually useful here. Public libraries started as a radical idea. Free access to knowledge for everyone. No purchase required. Now they're uncontroversial. If temperatures keep rising the way they're projected to, a cold sanctuary might be just as normal as a public library in 10 or 15 years.
Libraries already serve part of this function informally. During heat waves, libraries become de facto cooling centers whether they're designated or not. People come in, sit down, and stay for hours. The librarians know what's happening. They generally don't enforce time limits unless there's a specific policy forcing them to.
We've already built a network of quasi-cooling sanctuaries. We just haven't admitted that's what they are.
Right. And because we haven't admitted it, we haven't designed them for it. Libraries have limited hours, limited seating, and they're not distributed evenly across neighborhoods. The ones in wealthier areas tend to be nicer and have longer hours. The ones in the neighborhoods where people are most likely to lack home AC tend to be under-resourced.
The asymmetry again. The people who need it most get the least.
Always.
One thing I keep coming back to. Daniel mentioned the Nordics, and we talked about the policy asymmetry. But there's also a cultural asymmetry in how heat is perceived. In a lot of cold climate countries, being hot is seen as a minor inconvenience. You're a bit uncomfortable. Have a cold drink. The idea that heat could be dangerous, that you could die from it, doesn't land the same way when your summer peak is 28 Celsius.
That shapes policy. If you think AC is about comfort, then restricting it feels like asking people to be slightly less comfortable for the sake of the planet. A reasonable trade-off. If you understand that AC is about survival for a significant portion of the global population, then restricting it feels like asking people to die for the sake of the planet. That's not a trade-off anyone should be comfortable making.
The framing matters. AC is a luxury versus AC is a medical intervention. Those lead to very different policies.
The medical framing isn't a stretch. Hospitals use AC to protect patients with heat-sensitive conditions. Nursing homes use it to prevent heat stroke in elderly residents. If we accept that AC is medically necessary for vulnerable populations in institutional settings, it's hard to argue that it's merely a luxury for the same vulnerable populations in home settings.
The line between institution and home gets blurry when the temperature is 110.
It does. And Daniel's cold sanctuary proposal essentially extends the institutional safety net into the community. Instead of waiting for someone to end up in an emergency room with heat stroke, you give them a place to prevent it. That's Public Health 101. Prevention is cheaper than treatment, and it involves less suffering.
Where does this leave us? The problem is clear. Heat is getting worse. AC is both a solution and a contributor to the underlying problem, and blanket restrictions hurt the most vulnerable. The asymmetry is real. Cold climate policymakers are making decisions that affect hot climate populations in ways they don't fully understand. And the solution Daniel's proposing, permanent cold sanctuaries, has partial real-world precedents that show both the promise and the operational challenges.
The open question for me is, who pays and who decides? If this is left to individual cities, you're going to get the same pattern you always get. Wealthy cities build nice sanctuaries, poor cities don't, and the people who need them most get nothing. If it's a national or international climate adaptation fund, you need a mechanism that actually delivers money to the neighborhoods that need it, not just to the ones with the best grant writers.
The design question Hilbert raised, is this a cooling space or a daytime shelter? That has to be answered honestly, not papered over with a code of conduct that sounds nice but breaks down in practice.
I think the honest answer is that it's both. Or it'll become both whether you intend it to or not, so design for it. Put in enough seating, put in charging stations, put in water fountains. Maybe put in a couple of cots in a separate area for people who need to lie down. Staff it with people who have training in social work, not just building maintenance.
That's a much more expensive proposition than a room with an AC unit.
It is, but it's cheaper than emergency room visits and heat-related fatalities. And it's the kind of infrastructure that pays off over decades, not budget cycles.
The cutting room floor detail I can't stop thinking about. The wet bulb threshold of 35 Celsius isn't some distant theoretical limit. Parts of South Asia and the Middle East are already brushing up against it during extreme heat events. The study that established that threshold was published in 2010. It was supposed to be a warning about what might happen in the latter half of this century. We're getting there faster than anyone expected.
That's the thing that should keep policymakers up at night. The projections keep getting revised upward. The adaptation strategies that looked adequate 5 years ago look inadequate now. Daniel's cold sanctuary idea might sound radical today. In 10 years, it might just sound like common sense.
If you've got a weird prompt, a policy idea that might sound crazy but you think has legs, send it to us at myweirdprompts.com. We'll put Hilbert back in a cooling center if we have to.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who has apparently spent more time in air-conditioned community centers than any of us knew.
This has been My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.